I mean, hey, you're given your knowledge, and I think it's quite. It would be wonderful if you could shed some light. Do you mind, Mark, that we're taping this interview?
I assume that's your standard.
It is.
Practice, so that's fine.
Thank you. If we can all go around the room and just say who we are, for purposes of the people that'll be transcribing.
Okay, yeah. Mark Oman, I'm a Senior Executive Vice President of Wells Fargo & Company.
Robert Kellner, I am with Covington & Burling and counsel to Wells Fargo.
Derek Lawler, also with Covington & Burling.
Alexis Simmendinger, part of the FCSC writing team.
Tom Stanton, also with the FCSC with the research staff. We usually start by asking you a bit about your personal background so we can get that on the record, and then we can plunge in.
Okay. How far back do you want me to go?
Started college. At graduation, not.
Okay. Well, I did graduate 1976 from University of Northern Iowa. Degree was in accounting, and I became a public accountant. First job was in Des Moines in public accounting with what is now, I guess, Deloitte Haskins and Sells. At that time, it was Haskins and Sells. And did that for a few years. And then one of the audits I worked on was in Dial Finance. Fast forward, ultimately part of Wells Fargo. But Dial Finance, I went to work for them in the spring of 1979. Worked in, I don't know how much detail you want me to get into, a variety of roles. Was acquired by Norwest in 81 or 2. I think it closed in 82. And then in 84, the Norwest Mortgage Company suffered some financial losses. Actually, at that time, the largest loss in mortgage banking history. Doesn't probably hit the radar screen today in terms of what some other companies have lost. But they dismissed management and brought in new management, and they brought in a number of people from the finance company to try to figure out what happened and what to do, and I was part of that team. So I became CFO of the company in spring of 85. And ultimately president in around 89. And then in 97, I became a group vice president. So I had more than just the mortgage company and some other businesses. We acquired Wells Fargo in 98. So we changed around some of the businesses. But the mortgage companies reported to me throughout that entire time period. I've had other businesses in the meantime. Announced my retirement in the late summer of 2008.
Notional requirement of retirement.
Well, I announced I was going to retire by year end 09. So we started making some organizational adjustments. That was before the financial crisis that you're talking about and before the Wachovia transaction. So that all happened, and they ultimately asked me to stick around. So now I had the mortgage company. I picked up some of the portfolios from Wachovia.
Great. So Norwest was the dominant culture. When we read in Wells' documents about the culture of the firm, can one infer it's a Norwest culture that was brought to the acquisition?
In terms of which acquisition?
The Norwest acquisition of Wells, yeah.
I think it was a real mixed culture. There was in the consumer side, I would say it's more Norwest. In the commercial side, it was probably more Wells Fargo. The senior management team was close to 50-50. But Dick Kovacevic was our CEO at Norwest, and he was ultimately the CEO until he retired a few years ago at Wells Fargo. So I think there was a big piece in Norwest, mm-hmm. but not exclusively.
One of the things that I've seen is that companies with risk management have a certain culture about that. Any sense from which side that piece came?
Well, I think I would say, again, on the consumer side, mm-hmm. Where I was really focused, it would be a continuation from the Norwest culture. But I don't know that from a risk management standpoint the cultures were necessarily different.
Okay.
I think we had a strong risk management culture, and I think it's important, and we can get into this however you want to go, Tom, but I think it's important, and culture is exceedingly important vision and values exceedingly important. Those came, again, a lot of that came from Norwest. I'm not saying that there wasn't a blending of the cultures, but a lot of that continued in the business model was exceedingly important in terms of, I think, how we have built the collective Wells Fargo, the mortgage company's role within that, how we manage risk, how we diversified risk and thought about risk and those things. I think the culture, the values, the vision, the business model all played a key role. And I can talk about that more, but
why don't we start with the mortgage market and decisions and go there? Let me just ask a footnote. If we wanted to talk to a senior, sort of your counterpart or your equivalent on the risk management side at Wells, whom would we ask for?
Well, Mike Laughlin is the chief risk officer and the chief credit officer.
Can you spell that, please?
Loughlin, I believe.
Yeah.
He's on my speed dial.
Okay.
That's close.
Good. Thank you. Why don't we start with the mortgage market decisions? Let's not start too early because we don't have time. Start, say, with automated underwriting in the mid-90s and the relationship of the primary market to the GSEs and any influence that technology had on the way the mortgage industry evolved from about that time.
Well, I think a number of lenders were investing in automated underwriting systems, ourselves included. There were a number of private systems. So I think the industry saw that as an opportunity to bring technology to bear in terms of credit decisioning, but not totally to the to replace human judgment. I think the GSEs actually followed there. They were not the leaders in that area, but they I think identified the opportunity from an automated underwriting standpoint to use automated underwriting both to manage their risk and also I think to offer it to others in the industry because it's very expensive to build these systems. And a lot of people don't have the kind of data that it's required to build those systems. So I think the GSEs entered that market, but I can't tell you why.
Okay. And can you talk about mortgage market developments from 95 forward in terms of your customers? The GSEs in 95 had a lot smaller market share than they had, say, 10 years later. Can you talk a little about your product mix and whom you were selling to, or were you largely keeping it on the balance sheet?
No, and I don't know the GSE market share.
We can get the numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, you can get it, and you guys have done a lot more research. I admit I'm not doing a lot of thinking back in the 90s.
Okay,
here,
we'll move forward quickly.
But in terms of Wells Fargo, we were typically we did not portfolio much. We were much more of a secondary market originator and servicer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key. That's part of the business model. And I think, at some point, I think it would be helpful to talk about our business model and what makes us different, and whether that's now or later. But while we were originating the loans, selling the loans, securitizing generally through Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or doing some, private securitization. I recall 95 because that was a year, give or take, that we acquired Prudential Home Mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And they issued private label securities more so than we did, and we wanted to add that capability. And at that time, as I recall, about 20% of our volume was in governments. About 20% was in jumbos, and 60% in the middle was GSE.
Mm-hmm.
And very vanilla. We did not portfolio much, and that would be, we stayed very vanilla, by and large, through the entire subsequent years. Now, certainly we added products, et cetera, but we stayed very, you know, we were still very much doing FHA loans when a lot of people were doing a lot more non-prime loans. We were doing Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans when a lot of people were doing more non-prime and Alt-A loans. So we pretty much stuck by our knitting. We did do Alt-A and subprime, but not nearly to the degree of the industry. Actually, I brought a chart to show that if you're interested.
Yes. I would love to get into your business model. Let me just ask a quick question. Sort of in the 90s, the allocation of the secondary market business that you would sell to Fannie versus Freddie?
It changed over different contract periods of time. So we would be the largest seller to Fannie. We would then be the largest seller to Freddie. Then we'd be the largest seller to Fannie, back and forth. And we tended to split that up. You know, depending on the terms of the contracts that we negotiated with the GSEs, which involved a variety of factors. You know, guarantee fee, underwriting documentation requirements, servicing, you know, different things. So there was, you know, each contract was different, and we would negotiate with each GSE.
You mentioned the business model. It'd be nice to plug it in here. If it's sort of been a consistent business model over time, well, that would be great.
Well, it's been a very consistent business model, I would say, over many, many years. We re-entered the servicing business. We sold all our servicing back in the late 80s or mid-80s that I talked about. Sold our portfolio, and then we sold on a flow basis, but we really wanted to get back in the servicing business, and we did. We started ramping up in the very early 90s. With a view, as we viewed the business as a relationship business, and we wanted to be in both the production side and the servicing side to try to balance out the economics of the business, because in a refinance wave, when everyone's getting new loans, which hopefully all of you, if you have mortgages, you ought to be refinancing now because rates are
just to
50 or 60 years lows, whatever. Did you get in the threes or did you get in the fours?
I'm sorry, I got in the fours.
Well, you get a 30-year maybe, but in any
that's
event,
right.
When originations are going strong, that's bad for servicing because your servicing portfolio is running off.
Mm-hmm.
And when origination volumes are low because there's no refinance volume, that's good for your servicing business. And
very nice.
So we wanted to do two things. We wanted to balance the economics over cycles, but more importantly for us, and this goes back to the broader Wells Fargo business model, we're really in this to serve our customers and bring new customers to Wells Fargo, serve them well, and then have the opportunity to sell them, serve them, provide other financial products and services to them over the longer term. And you see that right in our vision statement, where we want to provide all the products and services our customers need and help them succeed financially. And we really mean that. It's not just some trite, you know, statement on the wall. We really mean that. Okay, so if you kind of step back, what does that mean from a mortgage standpoint? We're not in it just for the transaction. So while we may securitize and sell the loan, we're retaining the servicing rights. We're retaining our connection with the customer. They're mailing us their payments, et cetera. And we have, you know, if you want to think about it in terms of our mailings are correspondent to our customers monthly, we have that connection to help, you know, market other products and services with their customer. And what we really want to do is build that relationship so that if the time comes to buy the next house or to refinance, they come back to us.
And what about cross-products, credit cards, student loans?
Right. Well, we would market those as well as appropriate. So we, in order to do that, you asked a question, and I'll skip around, but you asked who regulates the mortgage company. We moved the mortgage company to be a division of the bank. It was a subsidiary of the holding company, and after the Wells Fargo merger around the late 90s, early 2000, give or take a year there, we moved it underneath the lead bank. And one of the reasons we did that was to, one, from a capital standpoint, and two, from just an ease of serving our customers across kind of legal entities. The vast majority of our customers were in the bank. We had a lot of customers. We wanted them all in the bank, which would help facilitate us serving our customers more seamlessly from a data information standpoint. So the mortgage company was regulated then by the OCC.
I understand the customer part. What were the capital advantages of becoming a division?
Simply, from our standpoint, as our balance sheet would continue to grow, we'd rather be funded and have the liquidity of the bank. And we also, as a servicer, we have a lot of escrow deposits. And have those, we're going to have them in our bank anyway, which is have it all in the same legal entity. So, in effect, our escrows could help fund our servicing asset.
Mm-hmm. So, since about 2000, late 90s, you've been a division of the bank.
Right.
And
so, on that business model thing, I think one of the things that differentiated us, certainly from some of the smaller players, the non-bank players, the shadow bank players, whatever you want to call it, is the fact that we had a servicing portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped balance our economics over cycles. But again, more importantly, we were taking a long view. We wanted to, we were serving these customers for a long view, and we wanted to have them customers for life. So we didn't view this as just the transaction. Let's make as much money as we can. We don't care what happens in the future. We're going to have that long-term relationship with the consumer as a servicing customer and hopefully as a long-time Wells Fargo customer.
I need to ask, because there is a certain other large servicer that didn't do as well as you guys. And I'm curious why that wouldn't be natural when you have $1 trillion of servicing or whatever they had. Actually, it was more than that by the end. Why they wouldn't be trying to nurture that customer relationship as well.
Well, you might want to tell me who you're talking
about. I was thinking of a countrywide.
Countrywide, okay. Well, I just want to make sure because there's more than $1 trillion servicer now.
Right, but these
Well, I really, I can't speak to countrywide, but I can say that, again, back to our vision and our values and our cross-sell model that, you can pick up any one of our annual reports going back 20 years. And, our vision was first published in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It has not changed. So I can, for us, that's kind of how we do business and what we're all about. Obviously Countrywide was not until the end when they became a bank for a short period of time, the savings and loan, they really weren't a depository. They really didn't have all the products and services. They were much more of a monoline organization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, again, as you start talking about the shadow banks, if you look at the mortgage industry where we are today, and I apologize for hopping around, but I know I gave a presentation at an analyst day earlier this year, and don't quote me on this, but someone can dig it out, but I think of the top 25 mortgage companies in 2006, there were only 8 left. Mm-hmm. By this spring of this year. Those were overwhelmingly banks.
That were left.
That were left.
So?
And the companies that were not left were overwhelmingly non-banks.
Yep.
Mostly monolines. Mortgage companies. Not exclusively, but overwhelmingly. And I think that comes back to, the business model that Wells Fargo has, where we are purposefully diversified in many, many, many businesses.
Yeah.
Across many geographies, where we can not only diversify our risk, but also diversify our risk over cycles, because we know we have over 80 businesses, or as John Stump would say, we have 80 businesses pulling the stagecoach. And we know that in any environment, economic environment, you're going to have some businesses that are doing well and some that are going to be doing less well. And we know that. Mm-hmm. But because of that, and because we know that, one of the tenets of our company is that you don't push too hard. For growth or taking that marginal risk, because, we'll trust the business model and there'll be other businesses that will be picking up the slack here and have it so that you're not trying to, push too hard an environment. I think if you're a monoline and you're only in one industry or only with largely one product, and the market comes and the market goes, your mentality of how you deal with that is going to be different. And I think what you see now is that the more diversified companies are still standing, where the mortgage might have been a big piece, might not have been a big piece, but they tend to be the companies that are standing would be the diversified consumer banks. And so, you know, my personal opinion on this is that, you know, I get concerned when I hear people talking about narrowing down Charters or Glass-Steagall or this or that, because I think the more diversified institutions did better, and the monolines, largely the shadow banks, are the ones that really had the problems.
Did it have anything to do with funding sources? Deposits are a relatively stable source of funding compared to what some of the shadow banks had access to.
Well, I'm sure that is part of the success.
Yeah.
But I also think having just the breadth of businesses is helpful as well.
So we will jump around in time. I thought that might be the way to do it, but I'm happy to do it a different way. So if we take the period, say, 05, 06, when the market started to really get exuberant and people were doing a great business in option arms and other things, and you weren't, say, and I'll be interested in how you chose products and what that process was like. Did you pay a price for that?
Absolutely.
What was the price?
Well, we lost market share.
Yeah.
And the market share that we did have was at a fairly low margin, because in many of our competitors, I think, we stuck to our knitting much more than the marketplace. So a much smaller percentage of our business was subprime and Alt A, and a much larger portion of our business was Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae. And a lot of our competitors were using those products. My perception is that they were using those products as kind of loss leaders. So the margin on those was unusually thin in those years, because the margin on some of these other products was unusually wide. And because of our mix of business, where we were much more in the low margin products, we paid a price that way. And we also, in terms of profitability and volume, and we also paid a price. We lost some sales reps to competing companies because they were doing other types of products than we were willing to do, and our sales force on the retail side is largely a commission-based sales force. And if it looks greener on the other side, substantially greener, some people are going to make that change. And I also brought, that's my other chart I brought.
Good. I'd like to see both of them.
Take them out, hand them to you.
This will be the start and the end of the visual aids.
Okay.
I suspected that you might ask, so I brought a couple of charts here.
Great.
There's nothing here that we haven't said publicly.
Great. I mean, that helps. Then we can
give you one of these.
Thank you. We may want to switch. Identical. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
that's for Alexis.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So this chart, the market share chart, we just simply show you our total market share over whatever that is, 19-year period. You can see, now typically when you come off a refinance market like we did in 2003, our market share would dip a little bit, like you see from 98 to 99, but it just stayed there. And this was because we were kind of on hold in terms of our product mix compared to what the industry was doing. And you can see what's happened once some of the players got out of the industry. And you can see when the non-prime business disappeared and the Alt-A business disappeared and you had to be served with more conforming or FHA product, our market share surged. And part of this is, of course, in 2009 would be because we acquired Wachovia, but that wouldn't be a huge percentage of that.
So what kind of mortgages didn't you make? Or was it really, you might do low doc or no doc, but you would do less?
Well, you can see on this chart here, this compares, now this is just the year 2006.
Okay.
This is out of Inside Mortgage Finance. So, and you can see that at that point, 11% of our volume was Alt-A and non-prime, and the industry was 34%. Mm-hmm. You can see in particular the purple bar, which is Alt-A, which is really, yeah, as you know, is more of an supposedly an A-type credit, FICO score, but much more limited doc.
Yeah.
And we were a very, very small player in the Alt-A space, but certainly you can see the red band in terms of non-prime. We're also much smaller than the industry. Conversely, we're much larger in terms of the green FHA,
right?
Which, you know, one of the things, because of the vision that I talked about earlier, we felt very strongly we wanted to serve the entire spectrum of customers. You know, so we weren't just trying to cherry pick the, you know, mm-hmm, the wealthy, et cetera. We were either number one or number two in terms of low and moderate income homeowners through this, mm-hmm, whole period of time. We were number one or number two in first time home buyers. We were one of the largest originators to the new construction market. We served the entire spectrum of consumers from non-prime to super prime, but we wanted to do it responsibly. And so that's why, you know, even though we served that entire spectrum, if you look today, if you look at our delinquency and foreclosure rate, it's much lower than the industry.
Mm-hmm. So could you describe your non-prime mortgages in terms of characteristics versus what you were seeing in the industry at that time?
Well, we made the decision in really 2004 to do a couple things. One, we published a set of fair and responsible lending principles.
When was this, sorry?
In 2004. And they've been added to since, but we would believe we were the first to really publish this set. And we talked about what was important, what we were going to be doing, you know, in terms of there's tangible benefit tests. We were only going to do loans if there was a tangible benefit to the consumer, if there was adequate disclosure, and actually our disclosures exceeded the requirements for disclosures. Only if consumers can afford, you know, to make their payments. I mean, you know, when they had the resources to make the payments. We said that if customers qualified for prime products, we were going to give them prime pricing. Mm-hmm. And there was a set of these, and if you're interested, we can get, you know, the list of what the our fair and responsible lending principles were back then. You can see them on our website today. Most of the industry didn't follow with those, but we wanted to be public with this. And as part of that, we also said that below 620 FICOs, we would not do no income verification loans. Our Wells Fargo Financial subsidiary at the time was also doing subprime lending, all for portfolio and all full doc, and never changed.
Really?
Yeah, and we through the entire period of time, we did all full doc loans, all for portfolio. So back to the kind of stick by your knitting philosophy. That's kind of what we did. As a result, you know, we were not as competitive maybe in the non-prime spaces as some other people. Sorry about that.
Got it. Historians will wonder what that sounds like.
Yes. Tom's still standing. So, in any event, I think if you look at our non-prime production, it doesn't stand out in terms of FICO or LTV. If anything, our LTVs were very modestly higher, and our FICO scores were maybe modestly lower. What really stood out is the percentage of stated income was much lower, and the performance in terms of early payment default and over many, many months delinquency and foreclosure was much better.
And how would you come to something like gee, we don't care for stated income if we're operating in a market where everybody said we're serving the consumer and part of that service is give them a mortgage that's easy to originate and stated income's a lot easier to originate.
Well, I think it was, I can tell you at that time that was it was a little bit of a difficult decision because our stated income loans below 620 FICO score actually outperformed our full doc loans at that point in time.
Okay.
So based on the facts, based on the data, we would have continued to do that business. We were concerned, however, that we've seen this movie before. I mean, if you were to go back, Tom, in the 80s, there was stated income lending. It stopped.
Yeah.
There, in the 90s, there was stated income lending, and it stopped. And each time it starts, it starts because it makes sense for consumers, a subset of consumers, and then if the quality starts to erode as more originators go from using that as a way to serve customers efficiently to using it as a way potentially to qualify people that may not otherwise qualify. And because we were in particular concerned about not having non-prime borrowers, well, not having borrowers with potentially lower FICO scores that could qualify as the standards of what prime and non-prime meant. And again, I hate to even use those terms because, as you know, there's no definition, mm-hmm. no consistent definition, and that is a band. There's some loans that you would look at and say that's clearly non-prime. There's loans that says clearly prime. There's a band in the middle that's gray, mm-hmm. and then that band changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
As the GSEs changed credit requirements, as the capital markets changed credit requirements. And what we wanted to do is make sure that if a consumer could qualify for a lower rate prime product, we wanted to give them that opportunity. So for lower FICO score customers, we wanted to make sure that we knew their income,
mm-hmm.
and could try to qualify them for that. For other customers, some chose to be stated income, and we'd have them sign a document that would say, disclosure would say, I know I'm choosing a non-prime loan that might have a higher, or a stated income loan that might have a higher rate.
How would you validate that they, in fact, could repay if they were stating their income?
Well, again, you're trying to underwrite, the job, their prior credit history, et cetera, to get a sense that they had the income that, that would justify the loan. I'm a school teacher. I make $150,000 a year. You can say, or a firefighter, a policeman, that doesn't make sense. I'm a firefighter, I make $35,000 a year. Okay, that makes sense.
So can I ask one more question then?
Oh, yeah, sure. the killer gnat.
Good.
If we had a white table, it'd be easier. But anyway.
You paid your loan officers on commission, you said?
At Wells Fargo Home Mortgage, largely commission.
Largely. And it's by your turn. Wouldn't they have an incentive to say, hey, trust these guys?
Well, that's where you have process and control on the back end to try to keep control over the process of having when you have commission sales reps. But part of the reason that's when we put that policy in is for if we're not comfortable that we can control a process, then that's where we would choose not to do certain types of loans. Or in this case, say stated income below a 620 FICO because we wanted to make sure that we had that information and it was documented where we could underwrite to that.
I just wanted to follow up when you said we'd seen that movie before, in terms of the 80s and 90s, as part of the writing team, and I'm looking at this. How did you know you were going to get here? In other words, just sort of in general, not in technical terms, but how did you resist based on what you knew from the past, to see into the future?
Well, that's a good question. I think, again, I would say it's part experience, part culture. A lot of it is, again, our focus. I think two things. One, beyond culture and values, which are huge, I think the two things I'd focus on. One is we continue to emphasize the mortgage banker model, and that is that you're an intermediary between your customer and your investor, and that you're representing each to the other, and that our job as an intermediary is to kind of look through the opportunity to the various products that are offered in the marketplace and try to find the right product for our consumer, and at the same time match that customer up with the underwriting requirements of our investors. That's what they expect to get this type of loan, that's what they get. And we would continue to emphasize that responsibility to our sales force. We gave speeches about it. When we saw some of the things in the industry that we didn't like, we continued to try to emphasize that this is our responsibility. And I can't speak for what other companies did or didn't do, but it would strike me that there was, certain companies were probably more in it for what the value was for the intermediary and not paying as much attention to either the quality to the investor or getting the customer in the right loan. You know, we're not perfect. No one's perfect, but I think we did it pretty well. The other thing I'd say is back to the business model of Wells Fargo. I kept taking a long-term view. Mm-hmm. If we're doing the right thing for our customers long-term, you know, we will win. And all of our CEOs for many years have said, we've never been successful when our customers aren't successful. We're not successful if our communities aren't successful. So, you know, if you're going to take that long view, you're going to try to do the right thing. And, there were temptations, but we were successful in resisting those temptations. In hindsight, we looked very smart. It didn't feel all that good at the time. We had investors saying, why aren't you doing these things? We had analysts saying, why aren't you doing these things? We were criticized a lot for, you know, and there's not some, you know, magic potion here that says you're going to do the right thing, but we tried to really stay true to our vision and values and our culture, and it worked out.
Was there a difference between the types of mortgages you would keep on your own books and the ones that you would sell into the secondary market?
Well, probably yes and no. I mean, fundamentally, we're not an originator for portfolio.
Right, right.
So the only times we would keep things on our balance sheet were generally loans that we felt had certain characteristics that either, like relocation loans maybe that mm-hmm. we liked, generally jumbos that we would keep. We had relationship products where we would give consumers a lower interest rate on a product because of their relationship with us, and we would portfolio those.
Your jumbo segment is a little bigger.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
The blue.
A little chunkier than
yeah.
competitors.
There I can see it better when it's right in front of my eyes. Yes. Part of that has to do with our geography.
I didn't understand that.
Well, being California based, we did a decent amount of California loans.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, we were a large non-conforming or jumbo originator. The lion's share of those were securitized, but we did portfolio some of those. But generally, those had a relationship component that made them distinct from the other stuff. On the non-prime side, we kept everything we were doing at Wells Fargo Financial. We kept some non-prime in the earlier years in the mortgage company, and then we ended up selling away the rest of, or almost all of it, or all of it in the later few years when we were doing non-prime. And on the home equity side, we basically retained all of it. So we could not, as a portfolio lender, it never made sense to us economically to portfolio whole loans of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, quality paper. The yields were low, 30-year life doesn't match up with our asset liability models well, so we would tend to sell that. The product that we tend to retain would tend to be more of adjustable rate mortgages that had shorter lives, either short-term ARMs or intermediate-term ARMs that had higher yields.
Got it. So there's no comparison. I mean, on balance, it's pretty fair to say that for the shadow banking sector, the stuff that was sold in the originate-to-distribute model tended to have much lower quality than the stuff that people would keep on their books. But it sounds like you were selecting for different reasons that in terms of the kind of loans you would keep, and it was a relatively small percent. I can go back and look at that.
Well, I mean, I don't want to comment on your first, because, you know, it all depends on how you define shadow banking system. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, Fannie, Freddie, FHA, I mean, there was a lot of high-quality volume done through that as well.
They were not included in what I was defining, okay. But yeah.
But in terms of what we were doing, yeah, we were not going through saying, oh, here's a loan that's really high quality, keep this, et cetera. It was much more blocks of product that hit certain ALCO requirements in terms of yield and duration and those types of things.
And when we're talking culture, when you would go to the MBA or some of these conferences and give some of the speeches you mentioned, that, you know, here are our principles of ethics, and they include not making loans people can't afford to pay back or variants on that theme, what kind of reception did you get?
Well, I didn't tend to do those speeches at the MBA.
Okay.
I tend to do those more internally, and uh-huh. Also had some analyst conversations or mm-hmm. presentations. Internally, I mean, it was about helping to continue to reinforce the culture mm-hmm. of the organization. We think that's very important, and we do it frequently, and we still do it because I think that we believe at Wells Fargo that is the more senior you are in the management structure, the more important being the keeper and the communicator of the culture and keeping that alive is a, even a bigger and bigger part of your job, because when you have, we're up to 270-some thousand employees, and you know, culture is very, very important in how you get mm-hmm. people lined up. So I think people in the mortgage company understood it. Again, it was different than what they were hearing from some of the competitors, and some people, if they didn't agree with our philosophy, might leave.
Mm-hmm. And what about at the MBA?
Well, again, I didn't speak to the MBA normally in that situation, but in terms of, again, some of the analysts and others, we were not considered. I mean, we were kind of the plotter. We were we were not as aggressive as others, and I think there were analysts and there was others that would have encouraged us to, say, emulate Countrywide more, or mm-hmm. others that were being, you know, booking very large gains and being very successful financially, and that we should do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a case of just, you know, saying, now we're going to do what we think is the right thing to do.
Any chance we could get a couple of those analyst reports?
Why don't you take that up with counsel afterwards?
Great. I mean, I don't know how hard it is. That was my real question. How hard would it be to get some? But that would be great. All right, let's go back to chronology for a while. We had left off in 2000. When did you first sense, I mean, now in retrospect, everybody talks about a housing bubble. What were you guys seeing over that decade of 2000 forward?
Well, I think we were not certainly seeing it like we wish we would have seen it. We were concerned in certain metro areas where we saw housing values going up very, very quickly, that for our own portfolio underwriting, where we make the rules as opposed to, Fannie, Freddie, HUD, everyone makes their own rules. And so we're going to generally use their rules or be tighter than their rules. But for our own book of business, for our own products like home equity, et cetera, we're going to make our own rules. For those markets that were going up in housing values quickly, We were dialing back our loan-to-value ratios. We were changing some of our requirements for, say, second homes or investor product, et cetera, to try to tighten down.
Tighten down while the rest of the world was
doing whatever they were doing. I'm just saying we were trying to be more conservative, and in hindsight, we weren't conservative enough. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, we didn't, I think, expect to see, and I think this is fair, that by and large, very few people foresaw that this was going to be the broad nature of where we would be today.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were focused on some of the larger markets and some of the larger markets where we did business. And some of the most hard-hit areas were not necessarily the large markets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it might be focused on San Francisco, but not Modesto.
Mm-hmm. Good. So I'm just trying to get a sense of what was going through your mind as somebody who had seen a lot of things before. As the market starts to really take off, housing prices really start to go up, why dial back? What was the rationale? What were you thinking? I don't know if you can put yourself back because so much has happened since, but...
Well, again, we were, I say, we weren't, we certainly weren't perfect, and if we had to do it over, we'd do things differently. But I think we were where we would see rapidly accelerating home prices. We were tightening down just because we didn't want to be that, as I said earlier, where you're kind of reaching for that last incremental thing where, you know, if values have just gone up 20%, and if you're going to do a 95% or a 90% loan or 80% loan, whatever, in that marketplace, compared to a year ago, that might be 100% LTV.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you start to dial back your loan-to-values somewhat to be a little more conservative, to provide a little bit more cushion in case the values were to snap back. So again, you know, where we'd raise our LTVs, lower our FICOs, or lower the LTVs, excuse me, raise the FICOs, et cetera. But you know, not hugely.
Mm-hmm.
Just that we kept doing that in some of these more rapidly appreciating markets.
And then this chart would seem to say you lost market share, but your bread and butter stayed with you.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it possible, basically.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, through that period of time, for instance, Washington Mutual made the decision to get out of the FHA business and to just emphasize non-prime and option arms.
Mm-hmm.
We bought their FHA servicing portfolio, their Ginnie Mae servicing portfolio from them because they wanted to get out of the business. And we bought some of their Fannie and Freddie servicing as well. And, I mean, it was just a very different strategy than we had in terms of who we were going to serve. Now, again, I mean, we did non-prime. We wanted to grow, you know, we wanted to serve the entire spectrum of customers.
Mm-hmm.
And serve them appropriately. And, you know, non-prime serves a very valuable role, I think, in terms of credit repair for a lot of customers.
Mm-hmm.
And has historically. And so an awful lot of customers that you'd serve non-prime would turn around in a year or two after making it. You know, they would have suffered a life event, a divorce, a loss of job, a serious health issue, all the things that typically cause you to have a default on your mortgage. You get behind. Now you can't refinance. You can't get a new mortgage. You can't whatever, you know, get a divorce. Someone ends up with a house, someone doesn't, neither can afford a house, you have to go buy a house. Yeah. After a year or two, you've got your credit repaired and you're able to go back and be a prime borrower again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we wanted to serve the entire segment, and as that segment was growing, we were growing in non-prime as well, but we just were not doing it nearly as rapidly or as large scale as the competition was.
For the historical record, council needs a brief restroom break.
Please.
Let's take a 5-minute break.
Let's take a 5-minute break.